morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. My guest is Terry Teachout. He's the drama critic for the Wall Street Journal. He's also a jazz musician and the author of many books. In 2009, he published a highly regarded biography of Louis Armstrong. And last year, he released a beautifully written and insightful biography of Duke Ellington. He'll be in town tonight speaking at the Enoch Pratt Library. The book is called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. And Terry Teachout joins me on the line from New York. Good morning.
No, good morning. Great to be with you.
So many people, you report in your book, place Duke Ellington at the top of the list of the great jazz composers in America. Do you concur with that assessment?
Yes, absolutely. He is the great jazz composer of the 20th century, I think, no question about it.
So we know a good bit about him, and you fill in a lot of blanks that we may not have known before. He was born in Washington, but you note that he lived at perhaps 14 different addresses in the first 20-plus years of his life. What was his childhood like?
Pampered. That's, I think, the first sentence of Music is My Mistress. And it's not an exaggeration. He was the apple of his parents' eye. He came from the black middle class, the black bourgeoisie of turn-of-the-century Washington. His father was a butler, which at that time and place was a genuinely prestigious career. And they treated him with kid gloves and expected him to do great things, which, of course, he did.
He was self-taught as a musician, which is
almost entirely.
Yeah. I mean, he played beautifully, but he also, you know, just orchestrated and arranged these, you know, very complex musical scores. And to think that he did that with very little training is really astounding.
Genius will sometimes break through the barriers of not being trained, and it did that very much so in Ellington's case. His technique was quite idiosyncratic, completely homemade, but entirely equal to what he wanted to do as a composer.
And he wrote, you use the term, he wrote on the band.
Yes.
In kind of a way that a choreographer, you know, places choreography on a troupe of dancers. He placed compositions on his band.
That's right, and worked them out to a great extent collaboratively with the members of the band. He was not a person who could just sit down at the piano and write a piece out note for note and then have the band sight read it down. He needed to hear that playing. He needed to hear their improvised solos. Not infrequently, he took fragments from their improvised solos and turned them into compositions of his own.
And he's received no shortage of flack for not being perhaps the most gracious collaborator and taking credit even sometimes for things that he really hadn't done.
That's true. I mean, his musicians had different attitudes about this. Some took it in their stride. They realized that without the magic touch of Ellington, you know, a little four-bar fragment that they made up would have just remained a four-bar fragment and not spun into a great pop song. But there were members of the band who deeply resented this process and felt that Ellington had taken advantage of them. Lawrence Brown, his great solo trombonist, who was partly responsible for writing the melody of the song Sophisticated Lady, sold the rights of that melody to Ellington for, I forget how much it was, $15, something like that. And his name disappeared from the credits forever after.
We're listening to some of Sophisticated Lady now. Gunther Schuller has called this technique of taking solos and little riffs and motifs from band members a perfect balance between improvisation and composition. I suppose that's what jazz is in general, but Ellington was really a progenitor of that style, of that technique, I guess.
Yeah, he really was. I mean, his great gift, Brown contemptuously called him a compiler, not a composer, and that's not true. But it does point to something important about Ellington, which is that he had very thirsty ears, and he could hear snippets of this, snippets of that. They went into the great musical factory that was his creative imagination, and they came out as fully formed compositions.
Terry Teachout, his latest book is called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Terry Teachout will be appearing at the Pratt Library tonight. Let's talk a little bit about some of the crucial figures in his life and crucial engagements. One is a guy named Irving Mills. Why was he important in Duke Ellington's career?
He was Ellington's first manager. He was a white song plugger who heard the band and immediately recognized Ellington's potential, set him up, essentially. It was Mills who bankrolled the band in its early years and got it into the Cotton Club in New York City, the Harlem nightclub where Ellington was based throughout the late 20s and early 30s. And it was Mills who really made Ellington a national figure. At that time, a black band leader in the late 20s could not have done that on his own. He needed the protection and support of a white manager. I mean, the world was simply too racist for him to function without that. Mills was a master of publicity, had an extremely clear idea of how to present Ellington, which was as not just your ordinary dance band leader, but as a major creative figure, a composer in his own right. And it was because of the way that Mills presented Ellington that Ellington was seen ever after as a figure apart from the normal run of jazz musicians.
Because it was a very crowded field in the 20s and 30s and 40s, certainly.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was what we now call the big band era. It was the time when big bands were to the music of that period as rock groups were to the music of the 60s and 70s.
The Cotton Club played a very important part in the story of Duke Ellington. The broadcasts from the Cotton Club became, in many ways, you write, the first association, the first interaction with black jazz by white people around the country.
That's right. As far as we know, Ellington was actually the first important jazz band leader to regularly broadcast nationally over a radio network. And because he was able to broadcast live from the Cotton Club, he was heard throughout the country in places where he wasn't known at that point. He himself said that getting the radio wire at the Cotton Club was the great break of his career.
Yet he was on the road constantly. I mean, right up to the, really to the few days before his death. I mean, he was just working all the time. You talk about his great fastidiousness when it came to his appearance and the appearance of the band. He traveled with five trunks full of clothes and an extra one for shoes. I mean, that's wild. Uh-huh. That's just wild.
Well, he was, it started out with Mills. Mills understood that if you're going to present a band like the Ellington Band as unique and special, they've got to look unique and special. And Ellington himself, who originally thought he was going to be a commercial artist and who had a striking eye for color and design, he took to this immediately. So throughout his career, he was very fashion conscious, not just fashion conscious, but somebody who was ahead of fashion. That was part of his brand, you might say. His brand was elegance, both in music and in appearance.
When we think about the great Ellington song titles, Satin Doll, It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing, Sophisticated Ladies, here's one, Mood Indigo. As a listener, as an erudite expert in jazz, you talk about the complicated history of this piece and who wrote it and who may have written part of it or none of it, etc.
Right.
It is very complex. But what's important about this particular tune? What strikes you as making it so iconic?
Well, to begin with, let's place it in history. When this record was made, the idea that you could have very slow jazz ballads was really quite radical. I mean, jazz was an instrumental music. It was a dance music. And this is not just you could obviously dance to Mood Indigo, but what it is a beautifully wrought instrumental miniature, one that combines that beautiful, slow, floating chorale melody that you hear at the beginning with the clarinet tune played later on. And it's scored in a highly original way. Those three horns that play the chorale at the beginning, people tried for years to figure out exactly what that instrumental combination was, but it was in a way Ellington's secret.
¶¶ He worked with U.S. made about 900 musicians over the course of this long career, including people, you know, who later became extremely famous and iconic in their own right. Billy Strayhorn, composer of tunes like Take the A-Train and many other great collaborations with Duke Ellington. Mr. Ellington took Strayhorn's death very hard when that happened, I guess the late 60s. The people in his band, they really were the muse for Ellington. I mean, he really wrote for them, didn't he?
That's right. They inspired him. He chose them because they had highly original sounds. He wasn't looking for great instrumental virtuosos necessarily. What he wanted were very personal sounds that he could blend together into equally original and new imaginative creative wholes. And Ellington's, one of his greatest gifts was the ability to hear the potential in a young player who had an unusual sound. Ellington could bring him into the band like he did Johnny Hodges or Harry Carney, create pieces that featured that player, use that player as one of his instrumental voices. In a way, that is, outside of the compositions themselves, that is his most profoundly original trait, is his ability to use other players and their sounds in creative and personal ways.
Your last book was about Louis Armstrong, and you've currently got a play off Broadway called Satchmo at the Waldorf. Any similarities between Ellington and Armstrong?
Besides the fact that they were both black jazz musicians, that's about it. They knew each other. They admired each other. They were totally different in temperament, different class backgrounds. Ellington, as I mentioned, came from the black bourgeoisie in Washington. Armstrong was the son of a part-time prostitute in the roughest part of New Orleans. They couldn't have been more different, and yet they did hear the great originality in one another and made a beautiful album together in the 60s and appeared once together on television on The Ed Sullivan Show.
Terry Teachout, his latest book is called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. It's published by Gotham Books. You can meet Terry Teachout tonight at the Enoch Pratt Central Library. He'll be reading from and speaking about the book in the Poe Room at 6:30. We've got more information on our website. Come to wipr.org/Marilyn Morning for the details. Well, Terry Teachout, thank you so much. This is a terrific read, a terrific book, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up Friday, Erin Dickens will be with me in the studio. She's an original member of the jazz group Manhattan Transfer. She's got a new CD, and she's appearing at Germano's Cabaret this weekend. Until then, for producers Stephanie Hughes, Matt Purdy, and Jamila Kay, for our interns Cassandra Morales and Justina Latimer, and for Sheila and Nathan, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Don't mean a thing. All you got to do is sing. It makes no difference if it's sweet or hot. Just give that rhythm everything you've got. Yes, don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Don't mean a thing, don't mean a thing if you ain't got that swing, boy. I said don't mean a thing, and all you got to do is sing like la 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 la. Don't mean a thing, boy, if it ain't got a swinger. Take it, chummy.